Return to Camp Blood, episode 32. You and your friends are dead. This episode is brought to you by FridayThe13thFranchise.com.
Jesus Christ. Jason's alive. He killed my friend, now he's coming for me.
He's got a death curse.
Jason's a legend.
I'm Mrs. Warren, an old friend of the Christies.
Jason belongs in hell.
You're doing it if you stay here.
Never come back again.
You see, Jason was my son, and today is his birthday.
Welcome to another episode of Return to Camp Blood. I'm your host, Chris, joined by my fellow counselors, Eric.
What's up, y'all?
Oz.
What's up, campers?
And counselor in training, Lando.
How you doing?
All right, so just a word about Lando before we begin. Don't worry, he's not replacing E. E is the only one of us who is still active duty military, and he's gearing up to deploy in a short while, so he'll probably, you know, miss a lot of these interview episodes between now and the time he gets back. But rest assured, we're working hard to get in as much recording as possible before he ships out, but his schedule is really hectic right now. We asked Lando to sit in with us because he knows his shit, and well, we're just used to having four of us now, so, you know, we got Lando. Anyway, we were all bummed out to hear that not too long ago the new Friday film has been pushed back yet again, but right now, thankfully, there's a video game in the works that is easily The Force Awakens for horror gamers everywhere, and that game is Friday the 13th, The Game. They've hit their initial funding stage through Kickstarter, but by the early looks of screenshots and navigation, this game is really going to make the old Nintendo version look like Q-Bert.
Hey, I liked Q-Bert. I liked 8-bit Jason, too. What?
Jason didn't wear purple. Damn.
And now we are fortunate enough to be joined by Wes Keltner, one of the co-creators of the game, from Gun Media, to chat about the progress of the fun and what to expect, at least at this point, from the game itself. How's it going tonight, Wes?
Hey, guys. It's going great. I appreciate you finding some time to reach out and get a hold of us here, because, you know, we're fans of all things Friday the 13th, so it was awesome for you guys to reach out and invite us on.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're a strictly Friday the 13th podcast, at least for the next year or so, so We knew when you guys announced that we had to get you on at some point. So we appreciate you coming on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Any excuse to talk about something Friday the 13th, we'll jump at the chance.
Yeah. So I've been following this project since it was called Slasher Volume 1 Summer Camp, you know, before it was even an official Friday game. And was surprised that you had gotten Kane Hodder, Henry Manfredini, and Tom Savini on board. How'd you guys manage to snag them before, you know, this whole Friday situation?
Sure. So, you know, we were at camp, and let me go backwards a little bit before I can go forwards. But our first game, as soon as we got done at it, we were consultants before, and then we moved into building games ourselves. And our first game was called Breach and Clear. And it was a military-focused game. And I sort of immersed myself in the world of Special Operations Forces. And I spent a lot of time with guys of several different branches, but all SOF guys. So that ran the gamut from Rangers to SEALs to CAG guys, et cetera, or what you may know as Delta. And I, again, immersed myself with that crowd and really tried to understand the content as much as I possibly could, and brought some of the guys on, that were former, to come on and help me, you know, stay focused and make sure I was doing things the right way. So I'm a strong believer in surrounding myself with people that are, smarter than I am when it comes to, subject matter and, you know, things from the weapon systems that we had in our first game, all those kind of things. I try to work with the best. So, and that was successful for us. We had 1.8 million players, which is not bad for a little small mobile title, you know, from a little indie team. And it was, I think it was because of the fact that there was like no stone left unturned when it came to, being, trying to be realistic and trying to, do right by anyone who was enlisted or former, that they could take a look at what we did and go, hey, these guys are doing it right. And that we think that that matters. So fast forward to making summer camp, which we're here, we're all massive horror fans, but I could say that all day long in front of any audience, and they're not necessarily going to believe. They're going to say, yeah, I'm a horror fan too. So what? So a part of it was, you know, helping bringing talent to the table that people kind of look twice at and go, wait a minute, they have who on the team? And so that was one portion of it, but it was also just, I can drive this, you know, ship so far, but there's going to be hurdles and things that, I didn't see coming, or the unbelievable experience and wealth of knowledge that people like Tom and Kane and Harry and now Sean, what they bring to the table, I can't compete with. And so I'd rather have them, you know, on the team helping to point us in the right direction and not hit hurdles that otherwise could have really took a shot to the fan base. It really matters that we're doing this thing the right way. So I reached out to Tom Savini first, and I quite literally went to his email. I went to his website and saw his email address, clicked it, shot him an email, and just explained, I'm doing this thing. What do you think? And he's like, sounds awesome. Here's my number. Call me. And so I called him and we talked a little bit more about it. And he's like, yeah, this is fantastic. Like I would love to do this. Yes, I'm in. So I was like, great. You know, that sounds like a perfect fit. I kind of have a wish list of other people that I'm trying to go after too. And he's like, oh yeah, who's that? And I was like, well, I've been really listening to Harry Manfredini's music a lot recently. I really liked what he did in the series. He's like, oh yeah, I know Harry. Here's his cell number. Call him. So I'm like, okay. And so I do. And Harry answers the phone and I'm like, hey, Tom gave me your number. He's like, sure, what's up? And I explain what's going on. He's like, fantastic, I'm in. And so I'm like, cool. Right. And so I'm, you know, kind of, you know, a little bit fanboying out a little, you know, like in the background, like, holy shit, like these guys are awesome. And I get to, you know, we get to work on a project together. And then, you know, another month or so went by and we were continuing to build the prototype of summer camp. And I sort of nonchalantly mentioned to Harry that, you know, that Tom's going to be creating a killer for our game, but that I wanted Kane to do the motion capture for that, but I was kind of struggling to find a contact information for him. And he's like, oh, let me text him. Hold on. So I'm like on the phone with him and he's like texting Kane, and Kane's like, sure, give me my number. And so I call him and he's like, holy hell. Yeah, let's do it. And so that was sort of the short version of how we got the team, you know, the guys behind summer camp. We released some artwork, we released some screenshots to the press, and got, you know, a lot of attention from that, and a lot of fans are already reaching out saying they were, you know, excited about what we were doing. We raised a couple bucks and had some money ourselves as a company, and we were like, yeah, okay, we're just going to go head down and start making stuff, and that was sort of the story leading up to, I guess it was around March or April or so of this year.
Yeah, and that was going to be sort of my next question. Was it always in the cards to try and make this a Friday game? I mean, I know no. There was another one in development, you know, a while back that got shit canned eventually. So did the shit canning of that other game have anything to do with it?
I'm not sure about whatever happened with a previous game. The way it was explained to me was there wasn't one. But there were some discussions and I think maybe some early designs and things that may have been discussed. But again, I wasn't that privy to that information. Because again, we were just, you know, we were doing our own thing. And so we never had any intention of working with a license or going to look for a license, like none of that. Instead, it was, we were paying an homage to 80 slashers. It was something that we all loved here. Unanimously, everyone here had some different slasher film that they really liked. And that was what was really interesting to me, is that each person that works here had a, not only a different slasher movie, but from a completely different era that they liked. And the more that we talked about those, and the more that we sort of shared our favorites. It sent us down the rabbit hole of watching more and more and more of them. And definitely, you know, jotting down notes and whatnot of things that we liked from certain films. But we tended to keep coming back to the Friday the 13th series because we thought it made for the best atmosphere and best environment for the type of game that we were after. That if you say, you know, oh, it's a 1980 summer camp and there's a killer on the loose, most people can kind of already start putting gameplay together in their head just right then, thinking of what that experience was like. So it would be somewhat easy to sort of elevator pitch that, if you will. And so it was, you know, a culmination of everyone having different backgrounds and different favorites, but then honing that down into something that was sort of more ran parallel with Friday the 13th. But again, we had zero, you know, it wasn't an interest. It was just, we thought there's no way that we could go get a license. Like, I don't even know that it was even mentioned because to us, we were just a small team that were just passionate about this project. And we thought, man, the red tape to do something like that just seems insurmountable. Let's just, you know, concentrate on this thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And so much so that whenever I talked to Kane at Days of the Dead here in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. and he was busy on a project. Then we went down, what was it, Horror Hound Oz, up here again in Indianapolis when we talked to Tom
Savini. Yeah, that was Indianapolis.
And he emailed Tom Savini, and, you know, Tom replied right back, I'm busy until December. And
yeah,
and so,
but I mean, that when we were there, he was totally, you know,
yeah, timing is an issue. I mean, and that's not a thing like he's blowing you guys off or anything. It's like there's even requests that I like shoot him a text and I'm like, hey, you know, this giant press outlet needs some quotes, you know, or wants to interview you. And he's like, oh, man, I'm swamped. Like, can I get to it in a week? And I'm like, no, it has to happen now. And he's like, well, you have to count me out on this round. Like, I'll get you on the next one. But he's just, you know, especially this time of the year, you know, it's sort of horror convention. The circuit is heavy right now. And so they're doing that, but they're also working on, you know, projects. You know, Tom's got his documentary that's going to be coming out before too long.
Kane had been working on his when we met him too.
That's right. And I think he was doing stunts on two movies. One was in the UK and the other one, I can't remember, somewhere here in the States. So yeah, it is a little bit like herding cats, trying to get everyone scheduled together to not only cover, you know, press interviews and otherwise, but even when we all got together at Sean's house, that was a feat in and of itself.
That's another guy we'd love to have on the show sometime.
Absolutely. And I think it's so amazing that you guys went for Savini, and Tom Savini being such a practical special effects guy.
Mm-hmm.
And well, in a video game, it's all going to be CGI. and that's right. I mean, I just thought the irony was hilarious.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it started first with just out of respect. Everyone here, we grew up watching his work, and what the way that he designed and the way that he brought gore to the screen wasn't just for gore's sake. There was a signature to Savini that was different, and
it was an art.
Yeah, exactly.
And
we were definitely drawn to that. But there are little subtleties that he does that I loved, which is a lot of the movies he's done from, of course, the Unholy Trilogy of Dawn of the Dead, etc. The Burning, you know, the Friday the 13th, the two of them that he did for that. You can see that he loves to do this thing where whomever the killer is, and he's even done it for a victim that's trying to defend themselves, but they have a weapon in their hand and they swing for to strike their target. And what he usually does is there's a there's a scene where you see the weapon come back and it's like the camera's tight on the machete, let's say that for example. And then the machete comes through the scene, and as it leaves the scene, then it strikes something real. So it'll hit a light, or it'll glance off of a beam, or it'll strike something first before it hits the target. And
right.
And so to the audience, you don't really notice it, but it's like sort of subconsciously reminds the audience that this is a real heavy, sharp instrument that can kill you. And then, of course, in the third scene, in the money shot, in the gag, you know, it's a fake weapon that strikes the victim. So I love that how he sort of weaves that through there to constantly remind you, like, no, this is a real thing. And then, of course, the splatter and the blood is freaking awesome, and he does that so well. So it was seeing that on screen and being like, man, he does that so awesomely that, yes, everything is done, you know, with quote unquote CG in a video game, so to speak. But we wanted every single kill in the game to its genesis to begin in real life, in a practical sense. And so there even will be some of these experiments that we're working at with both the animation team and the gore video effects, special effects team that's going to be working on the game, that we will actually build a couple of these kills real in his workshop, just so that they understand, because there's things that what they call in video games, there's volumetric liquid. So it's liquid that you have to program, create, and you have to add. There's a whole world of nerddom that we're about to get into, so I'm not going to go too far into it. But to make liquids look realistic in a video game, there's volumetric aspects that have to be applied to it, so it looks real, looks legit, and that has to start first in real life. And so they need to see these things occur and have Tom explain the reasons why this does this, the blood sprays this way for that reason, the blade only goes this deep for this reason, so on and so forth. That firsthand knowledge of tapping into him and asking, being able to ask those questions, is priceless to the team that's going to then have to go back and create these things digitally, but then also having Tom right there over the shoulder as those things are being made, saying, okay, no, wait, that spray is completely wrong. That's not how that should work. It should work like this. Or you're not hitting near an artery, so you're not going to get that kind of blood, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
So you talked a little bit awesome. About Savini and Hodder and Manfredini getting them involved. How did Sean Cunningham get to the point where he was involved in this?
So, like I said, it was around February or March or somewhere in that time frame. It kind of runs together now, but our heads down. We're building summer camp, and we're just kind of minding our own business. And the phone rings, and first I get an email from a name I didn't know, and it wasn't Sean Cunningham. And I was like, okay. And it's like, hey, so-and-so, I represent sort of part of that Friday 13th camp, if you will. And there's some interest that we may want to talk to you guys. And I thought it was felt kind of, I don't know, something was fishy about it. And I was like, I don't know. So I didn't even respond. Like, I just kind of got back to work. And it sat in my inbox for a month. Like, I just sat there. And then that's when finally my phone rings. And so I grab the phone, answer it, and it's like, hey, this is Sean Cunningham. And I'm thinking, bullshit. You know, like, no.
Yeah, right.
and I'm like, okay. You know, like, what's up? You know, and then the more I start talking to him, I'm like, oh, shit, this really is Sean S. Cunningham. Like, okay. And so then I start getting really nervous because we released our first concept art for summer camp has it's a picturesque scene of some cabins and a fire and a bunch of teens hanging out around this fire. And right on the left side of the screen is a sign for the name of the campground that these kids are all sitting at. And the name we chose was Forest Green, obviously a nod towards Part 6.
Right.
Yeah, I actually had that picture. I actually had that picture as my my desktop wallpaper for a while.
Thanks. Yes. So I'm sitting here thinking, like, oh shit, like we danced too close to the fire. Like he's calling to destroy me. You know what I mean? But yeah. it wasn't the case at all. He was calling to congratulate us on how much success we'd had so far, and that he really loved the visuals and the direction that we were going. And that he wanted to just sort of talk shop a little bit about what were our plans on the game and how did the game sort of work. And he roped in another guy he had there that was much more game savvy, because of course Sean is from film, not from video games. So there was somewhat of a language barrier when we start talking about asymmetrical multiplayer. He kind of, well, what? You know, like it's not his strength. And so he had another person there to sort of almost act as translator, if it were, if you will. But and so we explained through. We met with him a few times in person and continued the conversation. And that's when he came to us and he said, "Listen, I think this is brilliant. I think everything about this matches. You've already got my team. You're only missing two things, which is me and this license." And I said, "Well, first of all, that's like super awesome, and I'm like incredibly humbled that you think that way. But the other side of the coin on that is we're small team, small company, small budget. Like I can't afford a licensing fee. I don't even want to know how much it costs. I'll probably pass out if you tell me how much it costs to license." And he says, "No, you don't understand. Like the direction and where you're going with this, it's spot on. I'm bringing it to you gratis. Absolutely free, no charge if you'll have it." So
nice.
You know, after I, you know, fell out of the chair and got back up again, I of course was like, absolutely, yes, like, holy shit, yes. And he's like, great, cool, we'll, you know, we'll work out the details. And, you know, that was sort of the end of that initial discussion. And he hangs up the phone and, of course, you know, we're all like high-fiving and doing the happy dance and whatnot. But and then it kind of instantly dawned on us that this is way bigger now. Like,
huge.
There hasn't been one of these games for almost 30 years, and we just got handed the keys to it. You know, like, oh my God, like this. So all that started sinking in, and we started to get a little bit intimidated.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you got with that kind of backing, you want to make sure you get it right.
No doubt, no doubt about it.
Yeah, because fuck that game, the original game, man. I hate that game so much.
Oh, I did too, man. It was so, man, was so irritating. Every damn cabin looked the same. And but again, it was, you know, the time, the era, you know.
Yeah, that's our game. You won't be throwing rocks at zombies in our game.
Well, that's good.
And torches.
Speaking of gameplay, I get the impression that the game is going to be sort of like a 5-on-1 PvP like deathmatch type thing. Is that right?
Sort of. So there's 7 camp counselors and then one person playing as the one and only Jason Voorhees.
Oh, okay. So, okay, there's 7.
Correct. So it's 7v1 or 1v7, however you want to look at it. It's not a competitive game. So that's where a lot of people, I think, get a little bit confused, because they try to think of, what's another game that's sort of asymmetric like that, where you have one person that's doing one thing and then a bunch of people doing a different thing and they're against each other. And they go, oh, like Evolve, which if you've played any, you know, video games, Evolve was a game that came out about a year ago. And
yeah,
that's the only thing that people can usually try to narrow down to and say it's like, but it's actually quite nothing like it. And it's because most games in that setting are competitive in nature, and you can't compete against Jason Voorhees.
No.
No, you can't.
So it's going to be like a co-op type thing then.
You can play as a team if you wish. You know, if you see another counselor and you want to team up with them, that may
be. Or you can split up and go in different directions to try to take on an unstoppable force that's trying to kill you. That always makes sense.
If you want to be the guy that jumps on the grenade, so to speak, you can do that. Go run out and try to lure Jason away from the rest of the group so that they can try to plan their escape. Sure. If again, we give players just enough rope to hang themselves.
Awesome. Can players kill other players? Like, can you, you know, say, hey,
we're experimenting a little bit with things, but of course, when you do that, you sort of roll out the red carpet for trolls that will just jump into a match just to be a dick, and that's not good gameplay.
Yeah, you're right.
So, while it's really awesome to think about things like, oh, I don't have to run faster than Jason, I just got to run faster than you, so I'm going to take your knee out and then take off running. Like, that sounds awesome, and everyone's like, oh, hell yes. But again, as soon as you give someone that mechanic, someone's going to exploit it.
Oh, yeah, that would definitely make for a not fun match.
Yes, it would. And with a lot of people going to Perry to be the character of Jason, I mean, what, are they going to sit on infinite waiting on a round until they can actually become Jason?
Well, the way that the, you know, lobbies and basically the networking and everything works, that all comes a little bit later in the process of building the game. But the way that we built a leveling system inside the game that is universal, so that it doesn't, if you're playing as Jason or if you're playing as a camp counselor, you're still leveling up. Like, it's, if you rarely get a chance to play as Jason, you're still unlocking things that are associated with Jason, if that makes sense.
Awesome.
So that way, you know, if you I love to play as Jason, it's not like, oh crap, now I have to play as a counselor and I'm not earning anything, you know, towards Jason. No, it's a universal system. But that's where we spent the majority of our time, because we knew, even when we were summer camp, we knew we were going to make the killer incredibly overpowered, because that's what creates the tension and fear that we want. And if you see another player that you know you stand no chance against, you're probably not going to fuck around with that guy. You're going to try to get yourself out of the situation. And so we focused, you know, early on we have to make being a counselor fun. Like, that needs to be universally fun, and that you want to try to stay away from conflict as much as possible, which again flies in the face of most arena, if you want to call it that, arena type games. Other games, they hand you a weapon and they point you the direction of the enemy and they go kill that thing. Well, that's not this game. Like, you don't stand a chance if you try to do that. So you have to play smart. You have to be a little stealthy, use your environment, use the tools that you find, and try to get yourself out of the situation. And if worst case scenario, you do come face to face with Jason, then you hope that you have a decent weapon that you found, but just know that you're probably not going to make it.
Now backpedaling back to the unlocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, like, I know a lot of people are wondering, are we going to be able to unlock, you know, the different looks for Jason and stuff like that? Can you give us any kind of idea of what unlocks you have planned?
Sure. So we've already publicly announced that you'll have, of course, Sackhead Jason from Part 2. You'll have Jason from Part 3 when he first gets his mask. And then you'll have Jason from Part 7, which is the character we currently have in our playtest that we're running around and killing people with. So those are the ones that we have publicly announced. And there will be others, but we're not saying anything right now. We're kind of keeping that a little bit close to our chest, not just for PR reasons, but also because when you work with a license that has exchanged hands from Paramount to Warner to New Line to Warner Brother owns New Line, da 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 da, all that gets a little like, wait, well, who has the rights to this specific Jason? And that takes a while for everything to get worked out. If you follow.
Well, since Sean Cunningham owns the license, would you guys have to talk to New Line about?
Well, what he has and what he secured and gave to us is the interactive rights. So, if there was here's an example that you'll never see it in our game, is Freddy versus Jason. It'll never happen because that was New Line 100%, and that's not who's at the table working with us and helping us. So that's a difficult one for us to ever try to tackle. Plus, that's modern, and that's not necessarily the direction that we're going with this. This game takes place in the 80s. So it's more of that time frame. So, you know, one through roughly 8 or 9, somewhere in there.
Speaking of that, you know, this is taking place in the 80s. Is there any chance that we'll see Crazy Ralph in the early stages of this game? And
what's that you say?
You're going to Camp Blood, ain't you? You'll never come back again. It's got a death curse.
It would be a great intro to at least have.
You never know who's going to show up in Crystal Lake.
Nice.
Oh, I like that answer.
I like that answer too.
And just know that everyone that works here and is all affiliated with this project, we're pretty well versed in the canon and lore of Friday the 13th. So you may be pretty shocked at some of the Easter eggs that are going to be in the game. It's for the ultra hardcore fans.
Awesome. Nice.
So we might see some enchiladas.
Yeah, we know a couple of those.
I assumed you guys may eat from the same table.
Oh yeah.
Oh yes.
Yes.
Definitely.
So much so that Eric Anderson called us nerds.
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did.
And you wear that with like a badge of honor, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, we do.
Well, one thing, like just for an example of that is, as soon as we knew that this was a realistic opportunity for the license, we immediately started shifting gears over and started readdressing some of the direction that we were already going with summer camp, and thought, well, we were kind of already flirting around with Friday 13th. Now we can actually embrace this more. Let's do some things that we had kind of always wanted to do, but were kind of scared to do. And so we went back again and sat down and watched 1, 2, and 3 again, and really focused on 1 and 2 because of the, and you guys are, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but it was a very interesting signature that we immediately caught onto. So in part one, of course, you know, Sean had next to nothing in terms of a budget to shoot that film, which meant he didn't have a ton of money to pay for generators and otherwise to get a lot of light in the scenes. And so any shot that was at night had, basically 2 or 3 floodlights thrown on it at best. And what that meant was whenever he looked at through the lens, it was like, oh, it's too dark. And so he used primary colors in almost every scene. So if you go back and watch frame by frame in a lot of the scenes, anytime a character comes running on the, especially after the shit sort of hits the fan, you really start to notice it because it's at night and it's raining, et cetera, is that, you know, one person has a yellow rain slicker on, someone else has a green rain slicker on, and they're both like running through the woods and they're getting to a cabin and the cabin door is red. Or they're carrying a lantern that's red. And if you're not paying attention, it's subconscious. It just sort of goes right over. You're just watching a movie. But as soon as it's pointed out, as soon as you first notice it, then you realize it's almost in every single scene. And it was because of the lack of visual variety from, they had crappy budget, so they couldn't put a whole bunch of props and stuff in this campground. They couldn't afford adequate lighting. And so the alternative way around that is go buy some primary color paints and just start painting some props up, painting up some doors, and buy these primary color rain slickers and let's go with it. And that kept catching our eye when we were watching the first one. And so we adopted that, and it really started to make the game pop because we wanted it to be dark. But in video games, it's always fake dark. Like it's like blue twilighty dark. Even if you play the darkest and scariest of games, there's some games recently that have really adopted more darkness. But if you're outside in a game and it's supposedly dark, it actually looks more blue. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, we wanted more real dark without being, you know, you're just walking all of a sudden, there's nothing. It's just blackness. You can't even see trees in front of you. is we have some, you know, some campfires and some lighting and stuff that's scattered throughout the campground that works really well. But then we use the primary colors to catch the eye and direct, you know, you towards things that matter. That was a subtle cue that we took directly from Sean's book.
Right on. Now, I have a question. Did you guys actually go to Camp Nobby Bosco to check out the layout for the game?
We did not, but we are in the process of trying to. I know that they don't allow, they do like one tour a year, and then anything else is like private, which we're like, yeah, like whatever, like we'll do it. We'll pay you, just let us come up there and hang out. So we're trying to get all that squared away, but they just don't seem to be like really quick in getting back to us. I'm not really sure.
Eagle Scout.
Right? Yeah, I know. So if there's any out there listening to this podcast, like help us. Like we definitely want to get in there, and we don't mind to spend a couple bucks if we need to help support Boy Scouts or whatever needs to happen. But we really want to get in there. We've done, you know, of course the Google Maps and whatnot, and looked at terrain from that way. And there's a lot of good snapshots that are out there. And then once they moved down to Georgia and started shooting, there's a guy on YouTube, and I can't think of his name. I did know it, but I've forgotten it by now, who has gone to, you know, basically the whole entire campground that was shot in parts. I guess it was like six. And did they go to Georgia in part four? I can't remember, but he went down and basically took his camera, jumped a fence, and just started recording a bunch of stuff. So that was like really awesome to be able to see, even though it's what it looks like kind of circa now, it's still cool to see that from a first person perspective. We're doing our best to get as much of that information as we can. But again, since, you know, one is shot up there, you know, in around Jersey, one shot in Georgia, other pieces were put together in California, it's kind of like, this is the real Crystal Lake. And so that was a challenge for us as well. And so we looked at 1, 2, 3, and 6. And those were the ones that we're sort of making a hybrid of those locations and those sort of what the cabins look like in 6. We kind of dug that and how they were sort of laid out in a spoke or wheel sort of way. You know, when Jason walks up in part 6, that iconic shot where it says, "Welcome to Cramp Crystal Lake," and he's standing underneath the sign and you see all the cabins, like that kind of land thing that we're experimenting with, and we really like how that looks. But then adopting again some primary colors and some props and things more from parts 1 and 2, what the forest looked like in part 1 and 2, because it was more deciduous forest, whereas in the later ones when they shot in Georgia it was coniferous, so you had more pines and things. So each one of those adds good visual variety, so we're sort of pulling a hybrid of all of those things together to really make it feel like this is legitimately Crystal Lake. It's kind of like the best of all of those.
That's just awesome.
Yeah, no doubt.
We spent a lot of time just doing the post-processing, which is we're using Unreal Engine 4, and we really wanted to make sure that we could make it look like it had a film grain to it, because, you know, again, back then you had crappy budgets, you had a crappy camera, and you bought probably the cheapest of like quality of film to capture on. And then it led to like probably a crappy distributor after that, and they didn't spend much to put it on a film and then to take it to VHS, so on and so forth. By the time you sat down with a VHS tape and watched one, it had so many artifacts and so much, you know, cheap film and stuff whatnot that was in there, that the colors were like kind of washed out a little bit. You had like some blooming around the lights. You know, all these kind of like that, if you just watch it, you go, "Oh, this kind of looks crappier." You can tell this is kind of old, but when you really sit down and study and watch it, like that had like a texture almost or something. Like when you're watching that, you don't see that in of course in more modern films. And now it seems like when you watch a modern horror film, it's about making everything as pretty as it possibly can be. You know what I mean? And
yeah, but there's something about listening to a vinyl LP, sure, as opposed to listening to an MP3, that you get the pop, you get the grain, it has texture. I mean,
right? It feels like, and it sounds cheesy to say it, but like the distance between me and the director or the cinematographer seems less when I'm watching an older film, because I see all the imperfections in it, and I see that that light doesn't look super great, or that scene's not lit that well, or so on and so forth. But that graininess and that texture and that color and the like, there was light leaking and all kinds of shit that went on in those, that it created a signature of that time period that I wanted to recapture. And so many video games are pushing like hyper realistic, like make it look like, you know, it's legitimately real life. And that's cool, but that's not what I'm making. Like, we're not making that. We're making a Friday the 13th video game. And what we're looking at for that is Friday the 13th to happen in the 80s. And there's a signature of that. And so it'll turn some people off. Some people look at it and go, this looks like it's like last gen or something, to the sort of the untrained eye. But it's not like, if we turned off all the filters, people's minds would melt and they'd be like, holy shit, this looks like, you know, I've never seen anything look this realistic. But that to me sort of, it takes me back out of it then when I see it. Like, I would rather see something that I'm whisked away to that time period. I'm living inside a VHS tape. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I have a question about that. You talked about Easter eggs, and some of the Easter eggs people would be very surprised by. I'm just wondering if people are going through the game and whatnot, perhaps counselors who kind of lived on more than others from some of the films might just show up as they're dying, or to warn people off, like Shelley from the third part and that kind of thing, or Crispin Glover doing a dance before he gets packed up and you get to see it, that kind of thing. Is anything like that going to be in the game?
You never know who's going to show up at Crystal Lake. and there's all, it's also going to be things like, things you just may discover. It may not just be like a character in that,
like Mark's wheelchair.
I'm not saying that there is or there isn't going to be a character that may randomly appear. But what I'm saying is that it's more about seeing something like a sign, a prop, a something somewhere that you're like, oh my, that, I remember that, like that was in this scene or that scene or so on and so forth. Like it's, that's where we, how much we've studied, you know, frame by frame to match props even. Like we have an entire prop catalog that we've been putting together that are, you know, legit scenes from the movies where it's like, this is exactly what a lantern looks like. This is what a coffee can looked like in part two. This is so on and so forth. So all that stuff matters so that when somebody walks into a cabin, they're legitimately looking around at something that's, this is exactly what it looked like in part one. Like this is, I feel like I'm on the set of part one. Like that's what matters to us. And we think that's what's going to matter to the hardcore fans. And to someone who doesn't and just thinks it's going to be cool to kill as Jason, then to them, it's going to fly over their head and that's fine. They're still going to say, okay, yeah, it looks cool, whatever. But if someone stops for a second and glances over, we want them to see something that catches the eye and they go, wait a second, that is da 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 da. So
yeah, just long enough for Jason to come up behind you and hack you to death.
See, and that's an interesting point that you bring up, is that when you sometimes create an Easter egg that's so good, it actually becomes a mechanic that will kill you, because you may you stop long enough to smell the roses and then a machete is through your back.
All right, so as sort of like a final question here, because I know you're a busy guy right now, and I wish I could take credit for this question, but I cannot. Thomas McKean, who does the excellent audio drama podcast The Elder Sign, he wanted to know, you know, you talked about your Kickstarter and you've made it past your initial seed. Mm-hmm. What will set this game apart from, you know, like you said, Evolve, which did poorly upon release and sort of followed a similar model?
Sure. Well, the number one, again, I guess, is, you know, back to what I'd said previously, which is it's not a competitive game. Most people aren't used to playing a game where there's one person in the world that is incredibly OP. They are super overpowered and there's nothing you can do about it. That just doesn't happen in modern video games. Everyone what usually does is it's an even playing field. Here's your gun. Here's his gun. Shoot, die, rinse, repeat. And there's nothing wrong with those kinds of games, but they've been done. And so we're trying to do something a little bit different, where we say, no, here's this villain that every single person, for the most part, in pop culture reference, they know who he is. And what's interesting about that is whenever you hand someone the controller and they're looking at the screen and they see, okay, it's Jason, this is Camp Crystal Lake, I have a machete in my hand, they already know what to do. There's no hand holding. You don't have to explain the character. You don't explain the feeling. You don't have to spell out a narrative to them. They already know. And transversely, you spawn as a camp counselor and, you know, you're just coming out of a tent, putting your pants on. And maybe that's how you spawn. Or the shower is just being turned off and you step out with a towel on. And you hear a scream and that's how the match starts. You kind of know what to do. You're not going to just fiddle fart around. You're going to get yourself out of that situation as quick as you can. And so it's not having to handhold much, and that people already understand the roles they need to play when you set them in that situation. That's another thing that's unique. I think visually, people are going to instantly see that this is different. The hardcore fans are going to know that we are meticulous about staying with canon and staying with the lore of Friday the 13th. And the Easter eggs are going to be great examples of that too. But it's also just people in the video game industry, everyone uses different tactics and different mechanics to scare people. And, you know, a tried and true is a jump scare. And for some reason, I can't stand a jump scare. Like, for me, it feels cheap and it feels like anyone could have done it. Now my wife can come up behind me and scream boo and I'm probably going to jump. That's the same thing as when I sit down and either play a game or watch a movie that has a jump scare in it. I'm like, okay, you got me, big deal. You know, right. What's scarier to me is this idea of being somewhere sort of trapped, like in a Crystal Lake setting. And there's someone that's going to kill me if I don't do something. Like, I get myself up and out of this situation. If I sit still and just hang out, I'm dead. If I try to go face him, I'm dead. If the guy I'm partnering with is being a jackass and making too much noise, we're both going to be dead. So that is an interesting dynamic that I haven't necessarily seen in the world of video games come to fruition yet. I haven't seen anyone use, because if you strip it all away, it's basically a big game of tag, except Jason tagged you with a machete really hard. So when you break down the mechanics to something that's incredibly simple like that, most people can instantly understand and know how to pick it up, know how to play it. So there's not a steep learning curve, but the scare that's in it, the fear that's in it, it genuinely starts to feel real, because everyone has watched a slasher movie or any horror movie. And when the credits roll, they look at each other and they say, what would you do? How would you have gotten out of the situation? Everyone thinks they have a good idea. They all say, I would have done this. Well, I would have done that. Well, everyone has a plan until Jason punches someone's head off. And when that happens, it's literally like when you flip on a switch and cockroaches go flying. Like, that's what Jason is, the light, and you are the cockroaches, and you're all fucked.
Now, one last thing I did want to ask, and I kind of forgot to ask it. Will there be sort of like a single player or story mode?
Sure. So we do have a stretch goal to try to get some single player challenges in. And I really hope we get those, because it's a thing that I would love to have in the game, because it wasn't just something that was like willy-nilly just came up with. Like, we actually have already started writing the design on how that would work. And the best way to explain that is, did you guys ever play any of the Hitman games?
Yes, I did. I played the first
yes.
one.
Right. So it's sort of similar to Hitman, except they're shorter, sort of bite-sized, if you will. Think of it no more than 6-7 minutes of gameplay per challenge. And it would be a scenario where, let's say you choose a Jason challenge, and in that you may spawn in the woods in the distance, maybe 80 to 100 yards away. You see a campfire, you hear people talking, you see a few tents, and it just comes up on the screen. It says, kill everything. And You get, the timer starts and you just go. And you move into that campground, and there are, you can stop and watch and see and watch what each camper is doing and sort of memorize paths if you want to do it that way, and watch how they move and what they're doing. And then time your, you know, move in and be a little bit more stealthy and to pick them off one at a time. Or you can come in like a bruiser and just, you know, clean house however you want to. So you get, you know, some XP from being creative and using different types of kills. So sure, you could just swing your machete and you know, take an arm off or something if that's what you wanted to do. But that's not quite as creative as, say, coming up behind someone and lifting them from, you know, one hand around the neck, lift them off the ground, and maybe shove a tent stake into their eyeball. Like, that's way more creative than just coming in, you know, swinging your machete around. But if you want to play that way, you can. So that's what I'm excited about in the single player challenges mode, because it kind of lets you hone some skills and play offline if you want to. But to get like a narrative campaign kind of experience is incredibly costly. It's the most expensive thing you can do in video game world is make a campaign narrative, because it's the costs go for both motion capture, but also you 3D scan a person, you facial scan and mocap their face. You have to get voiceover talent. The list goes on and on. So I had to write it, of course. So your budget, it blows up to, you know, at a minimum, you would need, you know, $5 or $6 million just for single player. And that's not, don't even get me down the road of like making proper AI that doesn't do stupid things. That becomes really costly too. But if you keep it smaller, the gameplay smaller and more bite-sized, you know, controlled sort of atmospheres like what we're talking about, it's a little easier to pull off and doesn't quite cost nearly as much. So we thought that was a good exchange to get something in there that you can still do that's fun, that's offline. But again, we have to hit that stretch goal to get it.
And that's just awesome. I mean, you guys are doing this in, you know, 2015, and Sean Cunningham did it in 1979, and you just have, what, $150,000 more of a budget, and your production is how much more bigger?
You know, it's funny. When he and I were hanging out and just sort of, you know, sharing notes and stuff, he brought something kind of like that up, is that he's like, it's a really interesting parallel that when I first started, you know, we had next to no money. It was this, you know, scrappy little team, and we just set out to try to make a fun movie that scared people. And that was basically it. And we just had, you know, a blast when we shot it, and, you know, most of us didn't know what the hell we were doing, but we were passionate, and that sort of filled in the gaps. And he said, it's really interesting to see that, you know, that's where I started and then built this thing up. And it was the fans that came out in droves to continue to support and to continue to carry Friday 13th forward. He's like, it's really interesting the parallels that are happening right now. It's like history is repeating, and it's repeating right now, this second, as you're making Friday the 13th a game. He's like, we don't know what tomorrow holds for it, but if it's anything like the fans that love Friday the 13th, they're going to be right there beside you, helping you and supporting you and pushing you through this the same way that they have been for the film. So that is a really interesting, you know, parallel when you sit back and think about it. Like, are we at that moment? Is this it for, you know, what could happen in the, you know, future? Are there going to be multiple of these, et cetera? Like, who knows? It really depends on, you know, what happens when this game launches, what the fan base thinks about it, et cetera. But it's my job, and it's a big responsibility, but it's my job to make sure that we don't fuck that up.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, all right, Wes, we really appreciate you having taken time out of your day to join us on the show tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much.
The game looks like it's going to be a phenomenal hit, and I can't wait to get my hands on it, sir.
Thanks, guys. I mean, it was an honor to be on the show. I appreciate you, you know, thinking of us and reaching out. And it was a lot of fun just talking shop. And if, you know, if you guys ever want to do anything in the future where you just want to talk shop about horror in general, you know, that's definitely an itch that we love to scratch.
All right. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to the show at. If you want to support the show financially, head over to campbloodpodcast.com/donate. Send your questions and theories to our Facebook page or tweet at Camp Blood Pod. You can also send an email to feedback@campbloodpodcast.com. We also have a phone number that you can text or leave a voicemail, and that's at 757-637-0216. And also, please consider checking out some of the other shows on the Tangent Bound Network, like the network's flagship show, the Tangent Bound Podcast, The Night Keep, or The Hateful Dead. You can find these shows and many, many more at tangentboundnetwork.com. Our intro and outro music was graciously provided to us by the Downriver Rat. Check out his music at thedownriverrat.com. Until next time.